yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But I could actually read a little bit on the bottom. And so he turned back and lowered the line again.
Call to order the House Committee on Health Care for Monday, the 2nd of March.
I hate him.
And open up a public hearing on HJM 6. What do we have there, Madam Administrator?
Just reading.
Mr. Chair, HJM 6 is urging Congress to take steps to ease the physician shortage in Oregon. We have a Dash 1 amendment. The Dash 1 amendment just specifies in the memorial that it is primary care physician shortage. So it's adding the word primary care.
Okay. And
we have...
Who we have? Is that Representative Lively, are you?
Did you want to speak to this?
Are you?
Can I sit here or let me go down front?
You can sit there.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I have brought this joint resolution to continue to bring attention to the fact that we have a shortage in this state of primary care providers. It's certainly, in my particular area, it's in some cases a higher consequence than others. But at the end of the day, the federal government has a big part to play in what happens with residencies and our ability to train and keep physicians in Oregon. So the intent with this, while I share everybody's concern about what these resolutions ultimately do, I think we have to continue to express to the federal government their role in this and how they can help us in Oregon address this shortage that we have of physicians. And so there are several people here today that are going to speak on this behalf. So thank you very much for considering it.
Thank you. You call the panel, please.
Sure. Caleb Hayes, Debbie Farr, Alex Kyler.
And we have a large number of people opposed to this, is that right?
That's right. Overflow room, Mr. Chair.
Not counting me.
I didn't get it.
Okay. Keep physicians out of Oregon. We don't.
Oh, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name's Caleb Hayes. I'm here on behalf of the College of Osteopathic Medicine of the Pacific Northwest, also known as Comp Northwest, the DO school in Lebanon, Oregon. We're proud to bring HJM 6 forward with the help of Representative Lively, who assisted us in getting this drafted. About a year ago, it was brought to our attention that we needed residency slots to open up and open up quickly, and that there were some major policy hurdles in allowing us to get there. Recognizing that baby boomers retiring, the coming of the Affordable Care Act and the new folks who would be online with health insurance. Some time ago, many medical colleges began to ramp up and open up slots in the classroom so that we could meet the coming demand. But unfortunately, there are certain policies at the federal level that have made it more difficult to set up residency slots, which comes after medical school. And so recognizing that the crux of the issue is really at the federal level, and recognizing how quickly Congress has moved on some other issues, we decided to work with our partners and sponsors you see on this bill, many regular sponsors and Representative Lively, to draft a resolution that calls on Congress to take some real action to solve these problems and give us an opportunity to open up the residency slots that are needed. And that's seen in HJM 6.
I'm sure Congress is just waiting for this to
happen. Oh, yeah. I think this is what's going to take it over the top and get immediate action. The crux of the problem stems from Medicare caps that were set in 1997 through the Balanced Budget Act. There are some other ways we may be able to alleviate this problem that the memorial recommends exploring. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Representative Farr?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Debbie Farr. I'm the Director of Public and Government Affairs for Trillium. We're the CCO in Lane County. And I just wanted to give you a little bit of background. This time last year, Trillium had about 9,000 OHP members that we were unable to assign to a primary care provider. So as of April 1st, we closed to new medical plan members, and all of those new members for their medical portion of the plan were assigned to open card fee-for-service, which meant that all of those members would eventually be assigned to Trillium once we had provided assignment for all of the formerly unassigned, which we were able to do through a variety of strategies, including providing about $900,000 to open an additional FQHC that took 6,000 of those members. But today, OHA has reassigned those open card fee-for-service members to us, and we have about 12,877 adults that are not assigned to a primary care provider. One of our strategies has been around recruitment and retention, but certainly a great recruiting tool is to have a residency program in Lane County, and we've been working with Peace Health Medical Center to establish a residency program. I want to thank Representative Lively. He attended a State of the Delivery System conference at Trillium last summer on a beautiful day in June with a number of community members and policymakers to talk about what we could do and how we could form a community-wide effort to address this issue. And most recently, Alex Kyler, who is here with me, and I went to Washington, D.C. and took this effort before a congressional delegation. And I'm going to let Alex talk a little bit more about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Alex Kyler, Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. I also was at the forum that Mrs. Farr just described to you where we rolled out a sort of a strategy to how to deal with physician shortages. And for Lane County, our interest in this is that we have five health clinics mm-hmm. under the federally qualified health care authority. We hire psychiatrists, doctors, and we've really had a tough time recruiting people. So we're spending an enormous amount of public resources recruiting docs to come down to Lane County when what we've seen is that where there is a residency program, the data shows that close to 80% of those graduates stay in the community and become employed in the community where they've done their residency. So it appears that other places where there is such a teaching hospital don't have the issue of recruitment that we have. We did have a couple of very good meetings in D.C. Both Congressman Schrader and Congressman Walden sit on the House Committee on Commerce, and they've got a health subcommittee within that committee that actually had an open call for letters about the shortage, physician shortage, and we're following up with that meeting. Congressman DeFazio is working on a bill that would potentially allow health clinics to be more involved as a teaching clinic for primary care docs, and we're trying to get more information about how that would work. It's a fascinating issue. I applaud the HJM that's been developed here. I wonder if there's an opportunity to even bring this kind of concept in front of the National Association for State Legislators, I think, is that the NALS?
Legislatures, I think.
That one. It is a national issue. Apparently, it affects the western states a little bit worse than the eastern states. And I think that anything we can do to advance the issue is important. Thank you.
Any questions, Ms. Kelly? Representative Bueller.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. We have the same problem in Bend right now. We're having, for the first time in anyone's memory, difficulty recruiting physicians and analyzing the problem. The pinch point in the training system is really the residencies. The medical schools have been expanded relatively well the last 10 years, but now, unfortunately, we're seeing some of the students actually graduate from medical school, have substantial debt, and unable to continue the training because of shortage of residencies, which is really unfair to these people. Thanks for working on it.
Other questions? I have a question for Caleb, I think. Aren't there things we could do about this in Oregon to alleviate this? Isn't it partly a problem of money?
Yes, Chair Greenlick. There are some stateside solutions that Comp Northwest and specifically Dr. Drabelbis has put together as potential policy solutions at the state level. But we truly believe that this should be taken care of on the federal level. We do have other bills that could get at it on the state side, and I believe Representative Buehler also has a potential policy that may work as well. But I'm glad you heard this first. I'm glad this committee heard HJM 6 first, because we believe that's where the solution really is.
Well, it'd be great if this bill solved the problem. Thank you very much. I'm going to. That's all the witnesses.
That is, Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to close the public hearing on HJM 6 and open a work session on HJM 6. We have an amendment, I hear. Is that right?
Yes.
This one?
Yes.
Chair Greenlick.
Representative Hayden.
Chair Greenlick, I move to adopt the -1 amendment dated 2/12/15.
Representative Hayden moves to adopt the -1 amendments to HJM 6 dated 2/12/15. Is there any discussion? What does that amendment do?
I believe that it defines the physician as primary care rather than just
rather
physician.
Than general shortage. Any objection to adding that? So done. Do we have a motion for?
I do, Chair Greenlick. I move that HJM 6 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Representative Hayden moves HJM 6 to the floor with as amended with a new adopt recommendation. Is there a discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Does this like force Congress to fly some doctors to Oregon so we can have some more?
That's what it sounds like.
Okay. I'm supportive then.
I do need to comment.
As long as they're nicer than Dr. Buehler.
Oh. Well, we've just amended Dr. Buehler out of this.
That's right.
As long as they're not a toothache.
Yeah, thank you.
I do want to say, as I always say, I think these sort of resolutions are basically useless. If the symbolism is right, I'll vote for them. But I think if this is a real problem, from Oregon saying to the Congress, please do something for us when there are lots of stuff we could do on our own before it gets there, but we don't do that. So I think we do need more primary care residencies. I think we need about twice as many primary care residencies as we have, and I think we ought to be prepared to do whatever we can to get them. How do you vote, Representative Plum?
No,
we haven't gotten
to the
vote yet.
Yes.
Say yes.
This is a possible work session.
I'm still in USP, too.
We are, I think, prepared to have the roll call on HJM 6 as amended. Would you please call the roll?
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Kenimer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Wagner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenlick?
Aye. Motion carries, and the resolution's on the way to the floor.
You don't want to vote no, huh?
A carrier.
Representative Lively will carry it, right?
Thank you.
How about the physician?
Close the work session. Well, and I will say, the reason I didn't vote no is because symbolically I think it's an important issue.
Yeah.
I just think this is a weak way of dealing with what's an important issue. We ought to be prepared to deal with it in a much stronger way. Okay. Is everybody here? We have a whole committee? Yeah. Let's do a little work. I'm going to open a couple of work sessions to move a couple of bills, and I'm going to open one to get a little bit of testimony on where the bill is. But let me start by opening a work session on House Bill 2363. Madam Administrator, what have we got in 2363?
2363, Mr. Chair, House Bill 2363 added the requirement that a treating physician document in the clinical record any seclusion efforts to an individual with mental illness and who is confined in a hospital or a non-hospital facility, declared an emergency effective on passage. We had a public hearing on this bill February 20th. We heard from Bob Junedeff. It's back before us, Mr. Chair. There is a no revenue and no fiscal impact on the bill.
Do we have a motion?
Uh, Yes, we do.
This is an easy motion.
I know.
Why don't we see if some... Representative Knowles, can you ad-lib this one?
I'm going to try.
All right. All right. Last Representative Hayden ad-lib the next one. Yeah, yeah. Do I need that as a part of the basic motion?
Yes, you do.
No, let's not.
Okay.
Okay. Here we go. Mr. Chair, I would like to move House Bill 2363 be sent to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Knowles moves House Bill 2363 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on this bill?
I do, Sandy.
Would you please call the roll?
No.
Representative Klein?
Aye.
Representative Kenmer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Hayden?
No.
Vice Chair No?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. I'll carry it. Close the work session on HB 2363 and open a work session on HB 2368.
Mr. Chair.
Minister, yes.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, House Bill 2368 also had a public hearing on February 20th. This bill clarifies that if a person has both a valid health care directive or power of attorney for health care and a declaration for mental health treatment, that the declaration for the mental health treatment takes precedence of the two documents. There is no fiscal or revenue impact on the bill, Mr. Chair.
And I'll say I was the one who changed the health care instructions in the last session to allow a health care representative to admit somebody to a psychiatric hospital. But I have no problem with this being the person themselves declaring their instructions to supersede that. So I would recommend we approve this bill.
So,
is there any discussion on this?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I understand this. So the person can... I'm just trying to think of how this is going to work. So I would be able to admit myself to the hospital that would supersede a doctor? Or?
No, more likely it would be this story. If a youngster with a chronic mental illness signs a medical care power of attorney, say for his mother, and that includes most physical health things, but also would allow her under that to admit him to a mental hospital. But he, as a patient...
So the mother could admit her child.
That's right. If her child, I assume it's an adult child, if the adult child gave her the medical care power of attorney. But that patient also could create his own declaration under the Declaration of Mental Health Treatment. And he would say, I don't want to be admitted to the mental hospital except through a civil commitment process, then this would say his wishes would
supersede
his wishes
hers.
In this case would precede his wishes in the prior statement in the general statement of
got it.
Health care power of attorney.
Thank you.
Are we ready? Would you call the roll, please?
Well, we gotta make a motion.
Let's have a motion. I'm sorry, we were already in a work group.
Okay. Chair Greenlee, I move House Bill 2368 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Knowles moves House Bill 2368 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative
Clem? Aye.
Representative
Kenmer? Aye.
Representative Kenny
Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nelson?
Yes.
Chair Greenlee?
Yes. Motion carries. Somebody like to carry this one?
Now that I'm up to speed on it, I could carry it.
Only if you do it.
I can, if you really want me to carry it and carry it long and not short, I can carry it long.
Oh, carry it. Okay. President Widener will carry it.
If you're not happy with him.
I'll have Representative Kinnemer for backup.
I will close the work session on House Bill 2638, is that? Yeah, 2368.
Actually, Mr. Chair, it actually might be better if Representative Kinnemer would like to carry that.
Kinnemer, would you be willing to carry this one?
If you'd say please, I'd be delighted.
Please, sir.
Yes, sir.
Jeez.
I don't want to mess up your bill, Chair.
Let's open up a work session for House Bill 2234 for the purpose of taking some invited testimony to tell us where we are with this bill and who do we have coming?
Doug Riggs.
Call him, please.
Doug Riggs and Colin Holt, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs, I'm the Child Abuse Intervention Network here in Oregon. We very much appreciate you taking the time to hear this bill a couple weeks ago, and since then we've been in negotiations with OHA and with Mr. Holt at Regents. We'd come up with a Dash 3 amendment, which I think you have in front of you. Some issues were raised by Tom, and we had a discussion on Friday. We have submitted the language that we came up with on Friday to Legislative Council, and Legislative Council, I think, believes that they're addressed to the Dash 3. So I think what might be necessary is for Mr. Holt and myself and Allison Kelly to have a conversation with Legislative Council this afternoon to work out an understanding of what might or may not be appropriate. But I'll let Tom further elaborate if he'd like
it's
to do
something
so.
Different than the Dash 3.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt, Cambie Health Solutions. We have indeed had a couple of very productive and, from my perspective, enlightening meetings with Doug's clients and had discussion about the amendments. And what we came to the conclusion together on Friday afternoon is that some further changes of wording are needed from the Dash 3s. They're subtle but important changes, and we look forward to working on those with LC.
I can carry over to Friday.
Which bill? Today or Wednesday?
That would be. Okay, are there any questions? You guys are going to work something out as fast as possible. I was just trying to find out whether I can carry it over to Friday today. Or do I have to do it to Wednesday and then again?
No, we'll just reschedule it to Friday.
Oh, we'll reschedule it. Okay. We will reschedule it for Friday, so that would mean it would be useful if we could get the amendments by Wednesday.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And get the fiscal and the revenue. I close the work session on House Bill 2234 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2638. What have we got, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2638 expands the use of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program to include medical assistant recipients and coordinated care organizations. It allows the health authority to deny reimbursement of Legend drugs until 6 months after the United States Food and Drug Administration has approved it. And Representative Lively's bill.
Who are you gonna?
He's down.
There he went. Okay. You call the first panel.
Representative Lively and Tom Holt?
Tom Burns. No. Tom.
I'm
Holt.
Sorry, Tom Burns.
Tom Burns.
You both look familiar.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Lively. I'm the state representative from House District 12, which is Springfield. Just to provide a little background for my involvement in this particular issue, since I've served on the healthcare committee, I've attended several different conferences and discussions about healthcare costs and what drives healthcare costs or doesn't, and especially in relationship to the work we're trying to do through CCOs. And about a year and a half ago, I attended a presentation on a study that had been done about driving of healthcare costs, and there was two things pointed out in this particular study that was one of the primary drivers to those costs today, and one of those being pharmaceuticals, the cost of pharmaceuticals, and the second of those being administrative burdens that we all place on the medical field and the practitioners in trying to reach compliance in that. Now, recognizing that we make changes incrementally, we don't make them all at once, even though I'd like to see us just change this, I decided that the cost of pharmaceuticals might be easier to start addressing then the administrative burden, even though I know that our local CCO and some of our medical practitioners continue to work collaboratively on some of the administrative burden that adds to those costs. So I started asking some questions about the possibilities regarding pharmaceuticals, and my original goal and direction was the state buying pool, meaning that from my perspective when I looked at this, that the more the state could buy and distribute the pharmaceuticals versus what's happening now, the savings could be passed on. And that's when I met with OHA and we talked about what might be possible, led to this particular bill that from my standpoint is just another one of those incremental steps that will start getting at the cost of pharmaceuticals. So simply, and Tom can talk about the details of this particular bill, but essentially what it does, it just opens up the state buying pool to CCOs and others in order to take advantage of the cost that is achieved through this state buying pool. So it's one small step, but it's a small step that I believe helps lead to controlling the cost, flattening the cost as it deals with pharmaceuticals. Thank you.
Mr. Burns, didn't you used to have something to do with that term?
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm Tom Burns. I am the former, and I stress the word former, director of pharmacy programs for the Oregon Health Authority. I now am working on a slightly different kind of drug. And I'm here not to speak on behalf of the Oregon Health Authority, but to give you some background behind the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, which I did use to manage in my former job. This is a program that was created by this legislature back in 2005. It was designed to help those senior citizens who at the time did not have any insurance plan for their prescription drugs. It was limited to individuals over the age of 65 and with no drug benefit. In 2006, the voters by ballot measure 44 expanded the program to for individuals 55 and older earning less than 185% of the federal poverty level. Since then, the program has been expanded a number of other times, and at this point, virtually anybody in the state can get an OPDP card. They may use that card by going to the pharmacy and receiving a discount on the cost of their prescription drugs. There are about 200,000 Oregonians that carry the card today. In addition to the discount card, the OPDP program also manages and purchases drugs on behalf of the OEB, the Oregon Education Benefit Board, SAFE, OHSU, the Salem Hospital, and other private insurance plans, small insurance plans across the state. In 2009, the program joined with Washington, who had a similar program, to create the Northwest Prescription Drug Consortium. And the pool now within this consortium is over 1.2 million lives. If you were to ask me about a former job, when I used to work for a major pharmaceutical company, I would have told you that if a consortium came to us with a number of lives in the range of a million or more, we would have a frank conversation with them about potential discounts. If we did not face somebody with that many lives, we frankly ignored them. They were too small for us.
We may hear directly from them as soon as you're done.
I don't doubt it. That brings us to the problem today. In the original enabling statute, the law said that the program could not serve the Medicaid population. They did that, and I think rightly so at the time, because we faced a situation of the Medicaid program got a different discount program than the commercial program did. And given that this program was 100% commercial, the thought was you would not want to merge the two programs and meld those potential discounts together. Fast forward today, where we have a totally different Medicaid program in this state. You have the fee-for-service, which I would say still ought not to be merged, and then you have the CCOs, which are actually functioning as any other commercial plan in the state. They buy their prescription drugs through their ability to negotiate discounts or through a PBM. quite frankly, the CCOs in the state, once again, are not big enough to rise to the level of where you will find an interest in the major drug manufacturers of providing discounts for them. What this bill would do would simply say that if you are a CCO and you are providing benefits for the Medicaid population in the state as essentially a commercial life, that they would have the same right to join the OPDP program as any other commercially run program in this state. It does not mix the Medicaid rebates with the commercial plans. It simply joins and makes the buying pool larger. There's one additional thing on the end of this bill, and that is that many, many plans have the policy to not automatically place every drug on their drug list, but rather wait for 6 months after the drug has been approved by the FDA. They do this for a number of reasons. One is it's sometimes very difficult to understand exactly how that drug will work and what the payment structure ought to be and what kind of controls ought to be in place. And two is there are often times where a drug, when it moves out of the FDA into the full population, suddenly discovers that there are problems on safety with that drug and the drug needs to be reformulated or go back to the FDA for some safety warnings. This bill would allow the state fee-for-service program to delay for 6 months before adding a drug to the state's preferred drug list. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Very, very nice. Thanks. Are there any questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
Call the next witness, please.
Jim Gardner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeb Gardner. I'm appearing today for Pharma, and I'll keep my comments brief. There are two issues with this bill that I think you need to take very seriously. The first is an antitrust-related issue, which this is a permissive program that would permit CCOs to sign on to the state PDL eventually. When you do that, and if they were to act collectively or jointly in making that decision, you have a question that that would not fall within the CCO antitrust immunity that we created for them to operate internally. And I think you know what I'm referring to, because this would involve an external series of parties with whom who could argue that their customers are acting collectively and collusively.
They could join one at a time, though. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's a factual issue. Is if there is normally in the antitrust world, whether the timing is contemporaneous or not may be a factor, but it's not a conclusive factor. In other words, you can have people signing up to a collective agreement one at a time, and it's still.
But if they made independent decisions.
The question is, are they independent? That's a factual issue.
Or would the 16 of them get together in some way and say, let's all go into
that's the program? Or half of the 16. That's the issue. That's a factual issue, really. But it is an issue that bears some consideration. The second one is the six-month period. And I think that really that raises, we've never had that in the fee-for-service environment. We've had the provision that says a drug should be available if it has not been class evaluated, because you haven't gotten the factual basis for whether you want to put a prior authorization on it or not, or put restrictions on it. But a blanket provision that would say you can basically deny coverage, and that this would apply in the fee-for-service context as well as in the CCO context, this new ability to restrict access. I think that also bears some very careful consideration in terms of the drugs, which will tend to be state-of-the-art drugs. The newest one will be. They'll be expensive, but they will tend to be state-of-the-art drugs.
I thought Tom said this is only for the open card.
No, this would apply, I believe, to the CCO world as well.
Tom, you want to join us?
But it's certainly in the open card context. It's a concern, yeah, as well.
That's 100,000 people.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, Tom Burns again, formerly with the Oregon Health Authority. I hate arguing with lawyers, but
Jim's a smart lawyer, too.
As I read this, this is only applying to the prescription drug, the practitioner-managed prescription drug plan, which is a fee-for-service plan only. It is a guideline that the CCOs can follow, but it is not a mandate on
that. That's a better way of saying it. It is a provision that directly affects the fee-for-service world, but it is something that they can essentially copycat in their own formulary management program.
Would you feel better about the bill if that was amended out?
I think we do have concerns about the other part as well, the first part of the bill.
Okay. Are there any questions of these witnesses?
Thank you for your consideration, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2638 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2048. What do we have, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2048 kind of piggybacks on our topic from Friday. This is directing the Oregon Health Authority to adopt rules to allow the occupational therapist to participate in the primary care provider loan repayment program. And I can call the panel up, and there's also an individual I need to get on the phone.
Please.
Lisa Angus from OHA, and then Laura Lee Rebus and Nikki Terzia. Are you guys okay? And if you want to come up with Scott, that's fine, too. And I'm getting Lorena Hawkins on the phone.
Lorena Hawkins.
Hi, Lorena. This is Sandy Teeley Circa of the House Healthcare Committee.
Hi, Sandy.
Hi, Lorena. You are live, and your panel is up at the dais beginning to speak to House Bill 2048.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Who's going to be first?
I'm happy just to do a quick introduction, Mr. Chair, and then I'll relinquish my seat if that's preferable. My name is Nikki Terzieff, here today on behalf of the Occupational Therapy Association of Oregon, or OTAO. The association represents hundreds of occupational therapists across the state. And what you'll hear both from Lorena and also from Ms. Revis here to my right is that occupational therapy is so much more than what we all need for doing what we're doing. We need a different kind of occupational therapy in this building. But this is a place for us to come together and learn a little bit about OTs and also about the need for rural access to services.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to go first or Lorena?
Whoever.
All right. I think I'll because she's on the phone and from far away, I'll pass my time over to Lorena Hawkins on the phone, if that's all right.
All right, Ms. Hawkins, you're on.
Hi. My name is Chairman Greenwood and members of the committee. My name is Lorena Hawkins. I'm a student of Pacific University, studying to be an occupational therapist. I'm testifying in support of HB 2048. I live in rural Oregon, and I struggle with being able to be allowed to come back with a day school at Pacific University in Portland to come back and practice within my setting because of loans. I will walk out with over $100,000 worth of debt, and a rural area is not paying occupational therapists as much as an urban area. So I will have to make my choice. While I love Willow County and would love to return to them, I will probably end up practicing in a rural area, in an urban area, because of the ability to pay back school loans. But more than just paying back school loans, getting occupational therapy into the rural area and meeting this underserved population will help improve access for a lot of people. I currently am doing an internship in Walla Walla, Washington, and the facility I walk into, when I walk in, I shake hands with about three or four people from my home county, from Willow County, who cannot get rehabilitation services in Willow County because there is no OT. And On top of that, the Loudoun County has looked for 3 or 4 years for an occupational therapist actively and have not been able to fulfill the role. And since they cannot fulfill the role of an occupational therapist, in September of 2008, they were decertified to provide hospice care for Medicare. So supporting this bill and passing this bill, allowing us to be included in the language of who can apply for this repayment program, would put more OTs out there, and it would also help people like the Loudoun County, the hospital there, in retention of workforce and recruitment of workforce. Retention, it can help, because if you have an OT already there and they're looking at leaving, you can say, hey, we're willing to participate in this loan repayment program if you'll stay. As a hiring incentive, the hospitals would be able to say, we are willing to partner in this loan repayment program as a way to help you with your financial considerations through the loan if you'll come and work for us. Out of the 36 states or counties in the state, 12 of those counties do not have an occupational therapist within them, whether they're in the medical field, the schools, or mental health. They are just simply no OTs in those rural counties. So this bill would help fill the great distance in supporting OTs in those facilities. I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Do you want to hang on for the rest of the hearing? We'll be happy to have you.
All right.
Who's next?
Go ahead. Good afternoon. Chair Greenlick and for the other members. My name is Larly Revis, and I am here on behalf of the Occupational Therapy Association of Oregon. I'm speaking in support of this bill, 2048, this afternoon. We as OTs foster health and well-being in three areas: physical, psychological, and developmental, from infancy all the way to your golden years. OTs worked in hospitals, schools, rehab centers, community-based programs such as the pilot program at Washington County Jail right now, and other agencies. We also work as consultants for various businesses. Occupational therapy addresses more than just your work. It's from the time you get up until you go to bed at night. And what you choose to occupy your time with actually relates directly to your health. When that health is compromised for whatever reason, OTs are there to assist and support you through achieving that occupational balance. OTs use evidence-based research and sound scientific foundation to create a policy and practice to help their clients in rural and other areas to attain as much independence as possible in their own lives, and subsequently, hopefully, a healthy and productive member of society. OTs are well-placed to assist the state in changing its health care from a system of reaction, which we've already seen is not working, to a system of prevention. The designation of OTs as primary care providers in this particular instance reduces the overall burden of care. Research has shown that the inclusion of OTs in patient care is one of the most reliable predictors of favorable outcomes with inpatient clients, while the absence of OT services results in a higher readmission rate. We're talking about hospitals here, which increases the overall healthcare cost, and we're finding that a lot more in areas like what Lorena was talking about. We do have two excellent schools here in Oregon, and that is Pacific University and Lynn Benton Community College, and they are confident, I've spoken with them, that they can supply enough OTs and OTAs to fill the demand of our rising healthcare needs here in Oregon. These students, as Lorena has said, are really struggling to meet their debts right now, and this bill would be one way to try to mitigate that debt and act as an incentive to bring OTs, not just here in Oregon, from elsewhere, to try to fill those needs in these health professional shortage areas. House Bill 2048 does not expand the allocation of Oregon SLRP funding, but only expands. So it expands eligibility to us OTs who are seeking employment in these areas, like Lorena, who wants to stay in her area, where this need is really the greatest. The bill would support Oregonians who at this time are really limited or even denied access to OT services simply because these services are not existent. It's one of one solutions, or one that we are attempting to try to problem solve in order to create an environment of connection and care and encourage fiscal responsibilities for these new OTs and their employers. Thank you very much for your time and your patience. I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Yes, please.
For the record, my name is Lisa Angus with the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research, which is the Office of the Health Authority. And I'm here today just to give a little background on the loan repayment program that's named in this bill, which is Oregon's Medicaid Primary Care Provider Loan Repayment Program. The program comes out of the 2012 Medicaid waiver with CMS. One of the voluminous set of requirements in the waiver is that Oregon create a and dedicate funding to a Medicaid loan repayment program designed to incent people and providers, primary care providers to serve Medicaid patients specifically. When we negotiated the parts of the waiver with CMS in 2012, their focus for this program was on primary care. For them, that meant people who can be counted for purposes of the federal health professional shortage area designations. So that's the sort of priority focus for the program has been so far. I just want to sort of introduce one real practical consideration, which is the program's been around now. The legislature allocated the funding in 2013. The way it operates, and it's OHA, it's OHA's program, but we work with Office of Rural Health to administer the program, is it's a three-year service commitment. So the people apply and are scored on various criteria. For those people who are awarded, they can get up to one-third of their outstanding loan balance paid each year, up to a maximum of $35,000, and in return make a three-year service commitment to a clinic that serves a higher proportion of Medicaid patients than the county average. So we've been operating since end of 2013, early 2014. The award cycles are quarterly. With this latest quarterly award cycle that's happening right about now, we will have already allocated about 75% of the program funding. And because it's a three-year program, when you award someone, you sort of reserve the funds to keep their loan repayment going for that length of time. I think by the January 2016 effective date of this bill, in June we often get a large number of providers with graduation cycles. It's likely that there's not a whole lot of money left to allocate in the program at that point, unless the legislature decides to change that aspect. So that's just a practical consideration we wanted to introduce.
Can I clarify that? Because we were told with the tax credit program, as many people as qualified got the tax credit. You're saying with the loan repayment payment, there's a fixed pot, and all this bill would do is make occupational therapists eligible for competing in that,
fixed pot. Correct.
So it wouldn't have a ways and means.
No, sure.
Good.
Mr. Greenlick, Chair Greenlick, if I might, we acknowledge and appreciate the consideration laid down by the agency, and please know that we'd be very glad, should we have eligibility, of course, for any kind of deferred implementation would be fine, and we'll be happy to add our voices to the choir for those who would be supportive of further allocation to the fund.
Well, we could implement it at this time if we chose to, and they might not be able to compete very well for this round, but they'd be available for the next round, is that correct?
Chair Greenlick, that's a possibility. Okay. I think one thing I will note is I think we'd have to just chat with CMS about the parameters for the program and the eligibility criteria. It's not articulated in the waiver, but it's something we communicate with them about and report to them on the operation of the waiver. So, but that's a possibility of the conversation.
Good. Okay, are there questions in this panel? Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Chair.
Ms. Chair.
What's the percentage of people that get in who apply to this currently, and then how is that selection chosen?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer, I don't have the percentage off the top of my head. I know we've made around 35 or 36 awards so far, and there are probably, so I imagine it's probably a factor of five above that in terms of applicants. But we can check on that for you. To your question about how are the awards made, there's the Office of Rural Health convenes an advisory committee that helps choose the awards. The applications are scored on several factors. The location in a health professional shortage area. Oh, and I did want to clarify also that the program is not just aimed at rural areas. It's aimed at areas that have a high volume of Medicaid eligibles. So health professional shortage area, there is there are points awarded for professionals who are offering their services in conjunction with a patient center primary care home, because we're interested in both in access and access to a transformed system of care. And there are points awarded for the degree to which the clinic or practice that the provider is affiliated with sees more Medicaid patients than the county in the area. And I think that's all of the criteria, but I will double check and get back to you.
That's great. Just a quick follow-up. I know there's a Senate bill coming through that's looking at really collecting data on workforce needs according to different rural areas in that particular case, and I'm assuming that you all are keeping in close touch with that, because I think these are all good combined efforts.
Yes, thank you.
Any other questions, this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Please call the next panel.
Scott Ekblad and Doug Barber.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health, which is located at Oregon Health and Science University. And in an effort to be efficient, I'm going to simply state the things that Lisa Angus has not already. But as she mentioned, this is a program that was created within the Oregon Health Authority. They contract with the Oregon Office of Rural Health to administer the award process. The eligible professions, I should note, are not in statute. It gives OHA the authority to determine which professions are eligible for the program, and so that's something that was done by rule. And as it currently is, it's dentists, expanded practice dental hygienists, physicians in certain primary care specialties, physician assistants in those same specialties, nurse practitioners in adult health, women's health care, geriatrics, pediatrics, psychiatric, mental health, family practice, or nurse midwifery, clinical psychologists, clinical social workers, and marriage and family therapists. So those are the professions that are currently eligible for this loan repayment program. There was about $3.6 million available to be awarded. And as Lisa mentioned, we've made five cycles to this point, five out of a planned eight. To be perfectly honest, we hope to run out of money, so to speak, before we get to eight cycles, and I think we're closing in on that very well. To date, 179 applications have been received for loan repayment, and we've been able to make 26 awards. So far greater number of people applying for loan repayment than we've been able to give. Just for interest, 14 are in urban sites, 12 are in rural. The professional breakdown is 6 physicians, 9 nurse practitioners, 2 physician assistants, 7 dentists, and 2 psychiatrists. So we have obligated approximately $2,777,000. As Lisa mentioned, when you make a loan repayment award, you set aside the entire 3 years' worth of award. We have about $823,000 left to award during this biennium. I should also note that even though those awards have been made, the responsibility for the Office of Rural Health to monitor those people and make sure they fulfill their obligations as those 3 years go by, even though we don't have loan repayment money anymore, those responsibilities will continue to rest within my office. I would imagine what this committee would like to know is what would the impact be if we were to add occupational therapists to this program, and frankly, the answer is I can't tell you, because not only do I not even know if there's going to be a pie next time around, the legislature will have to fund it. I don't know how big a slice the pie occupational therapists would be. I would need to get some sort of idea of how we go about determining in which situations occupational therapists could get awards. So with that, I'll probably end my testimony. I'm neither in support or opposed to this bill. There's an awful lot of healthcare professions that are desperately needed in both urban and rural Oregon. But I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Bueller.
Just thank you, Chair Greenlick. Just for clarifications, physical therapists right now don't qualify.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, that's true.
I want to remind everybody, in case they don't remember, this was Bob Jensen's bill that he left for us on his way into retirement.
Quick question.
Yes, sir.
Quick question. Thank you, Chair Greenlick. So I've been curious about a lot of these programs, and there seems to be about 14 of them in the state to try and shore up healthcare providers, usually under the intent of rural. And when you start to look into those programs, there's often carve-outs for Medicaid or, you know, depressed areas. And like you just mentioned, actually 14 of the programs are in urban and 12 are in rural. So they often end up not really being split out the way that they seem to be presented on the outset. And so I've often wondered why, and I don't know if you can answer this, why aren't these types of programs, and not necessarily this one specifically, set towards an equity-based, meaning you've got four physicians versus, you know, 1,000 people, just general population, not necessarily a certain type of insurance, but general population in the urban area, maybe you have four physicians to take care of that, or maybe you have more. But when you look at a map, you can always look at these rural areas. It's almost double in each of the cases, where the population doubles the amount of physicians. Why don't we ever tie these programs to an equitable ratio based on actually populations there and the amount of physicians rather than insurance or underserved areas, depressed economy, that kind of thing?
Representative Greenlick and Vice Chair Hayden, it should be noted that this particular loan repayment program was never intended to be specific to rural, and I understand that's not what you were implying either. It was really intended to expand access to the newly enrolled Medicaid population, and of course urban sites see a lot more Medicaid patients, just talking sheer volume, I think, than rural communities. So I'm not surprised that it's split about halfway down the middle. I should mention that there has been a bill introduced this session that would continue this particular program and allow us to make some of the changes that really you're asking about, and that is, rather than following what the federal government wanted this program to do, let the state determine what the eligibility criteria are and what the purpose is. So going forward, I would hope that the advisory committee would, in fact, look at exactly what you've discussed.
Thank you.
Doug?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Oregon Rural Health Association. As Scott mentioned, the loan repayment program historically was targeted at rural Oregon. The funding for that program ended in 2009, I believe. Then it was recreated in a new life in the 2013 session with a new focus, which was Medicaid. But it was rural and urban underserved was added. As Scott mentioned, what we've already seen is that the urban underserved is taking, at this point, more than half of that pie. Our concern from the Rural Health Association is trying to attract providers in rural Oregon. And what we hear consistently from clinics there is huge demand for primary care providers, for psychiatrists, for general surgeons. We haven't heard a lot about the need for occupational therapists. And so it's sort of a word of caution about expanding the pool. We've already had 179 applicants. Many I've heard from a number of those communities about why couldn't we get, we had a great doctor who was going to come to this location, but didn't get through the screening process and wasn't one of the 26 that was chosen. I mean, there's a lot of demand for this program and a limited pool of funds. As Scott mentioned, we don't know what that limit's going to be in the upcoming session, but it's just a sort of a, I guess we're taking a wait and see attitude until we see sort of how much is really available. Thank you.
And that informal contact, did you ask whether they were having trouble recruiting occupational therapists or whether they cared about it? Or?
We'll circulate to all of our members and try to get an answer to what's the demand.
Chair Greenlick, if I may just comment, we in the Office of Rural Health do occasionally hear from folks saying we have difficulty recruiting occupational therapists, we have difficulty recruiting physical therapists. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I thought this came from Eastern Oregon as an issue. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is that it for the witnesses?
That is it for the witnesses.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2048. Is there nothing further to be brought before the committee? We're getting off easy today.
We are.
We are adjourned.
Wow.
Amazing.
So we're not starting to see.
Amazing.
So we're not starting to see.